Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for DebtWire Municipals. Today's podcast title is Hawaiian Electric, 1 year later. Joining me today to discuss Hawaiian Electric is John Sinner, who's a credit analyst for our sister publication, DebtWire North America, and has been following Hawaiian Electric Industries Incorporated. John, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, Paul. Happy to be here. Happy fall as well.
Thank you. So happy fall back to you. So you were here literally about a year ago to talk about the situation in Maui with the wildfires and how it impacted Hawaiian Electric. And I want to fast forward with you to where we are today and just get a sense from you. Well, what's changed since the wildfires happened? And initially, I remember we talked a little bit about in that first podcast about the bank that the Hawaiian Electric owned and potential complications that could cause. Well, what's happened since, you know, we had that first conversation?
Sure. Happy to address it. And I'll go over what I think are the key items. You know, a lot's happened in the past year. Paul, you mentioned right off the bat the bank. When we last chatted, I think we went in length about thoughts around the potential for them to have to sell the bank, you know, regulators maybe asking them to do something with the bank. It appears as though the company's decided to, quote unquote, pursue strategic alternatives, which in the world of finance usually means that they want to try to sell it. So they're going down that path in some form. You know, whether that's going to be successful, we don't know. I would put that in the we kind of thought about it category. Second big thing that happened for them, Hawaiian Electric arranged a new financing facility. Why is this important? You know, given all that's gone on with the company in the past year, your access to capital markets is always, call it, problematic after an event like that. In the good column for them, they now can raise up to $250 million or borrow $250 million using accounts receivable as collateral. So that puts them in a position where as these maturities come due in the next couple of years, probably okay. So let's put that in, you know, in the good column as well. Also important, Hawaiian Electric has partnered, and I don't mean that in like an official sense, but they, along with the state of Hawaii, created a victims fund. So they contributed funds. I think it was $75 million each. Don't hold me to it, but I think it was $150 million fund where the victims of the wildfire can access funds if they so desire. I don't want to go into intense detail about how that works, but that's occurred. So there's, you know, supporting the community with these contributions. And then last but not least, around a month ago, almost in the first anniversary of the fire, it was announced that parties, and I'll talk about who those are in a second, had reached a global settlement around the wildfire. And the headline number there is $4 billion. And when I say parties, including Hawaiian Electric and others, have agreed to contribute funds. Hawaiian Electric's piece is about $2 billion. And in exchange for that, parties that were damaged, you know, people that were uninsured, underinsured, who we'll call the plaintiffs, have signed on to this deal. But also, most interestingly, the subrogation insurance claim holders have not. We're going to talk about that more in length. That's a quick overview of what's happened in the past year that I think is important. Obviously, a lot more has happened, but those are the big items.
Right. Just so I'm clear, Hawaiian Electric Industries, which is the parent company, owns American Savings Bank. And the reason why that came up, because that seemed pretty unusual to have a bank own a utility. So that's what caused that initial conversation. But now we've moved forward. Issues seem to have changed. And more importantly, what issues remain unresolved right now?
And that's a great question as well, Paul. A few things, and we'll kind of touch on those that is what's changed. In no particular order, you know, we talked about this settlement, and we're going to talk about that more today, but is that going to hold? So it's been announced. It seems as though certain parties have signed on to it. There's some legal processes going on. I think the most important, where do we go from here, or what's not resolved, is the settlement that's resolved. So I know it's sort of confusing, but let's put that in the actually not resolved camp. So that's important. You know, assuming some sort of deal comes together, whether it's the one that's on the table, something else, how is Hawaiian Electric going to pay its share? And right now in this global settlement, it's a $2 billion number. They've announced, I would put it in sort of like ambiguous terms, debt capital, equity linked, equity, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they've said that they're going to use all these different options to raise the $2 billion, but they don't have like a plan that's A to B to C. In fact, some of the ratings agencies have noted the ambiguity and noted that they have questions about that. So that remains unresolved. And then related to the deal, this was probably like a B to the A. What are the subrogation insurance claim holders going to do? That remains unresolved as well. That involves this global settlement deal, but what are they going to do? And we'll talk about that a little more today as well. So for me, those are the big unresolved issues.
So about a month ago, Governor Josh Green of Hawaii made this big announcement with a lot of fanfare that there was this global settlement that you've mentioned. But as you also mentioned, there's not buy-in, at least not right now, by the insurance industry. My question to you is, can this agreement happen without that buy-in from the insurance industry? And the reason why I ask it in that way, because it seems like Governor Green thinks that it can. But is that realistic, or what's your thoughts on that?
It's a complex question. It's a good one. I can answer both ways. So yes, the deal can occur, which I would have said no a couple of weeks ago. But the legal process that has developed over the past couple of weeks and over the past month suggests that this deal, you know, might be rammed through. I hate to use that word. It's dramatic, but it's probably the right way to say it. So yes, but also no, because you do need all these parties to buy in to have a deal that, you know, that is agreeable all around. So it's very divisive right now. So there's a lot of drama around it. I think maybe to answer your question simply, there is a strong possibility that what's been put on the table holds, but there are ramifications if that does hold. And that might be, you know, kind of the crux of the situation right now, that this deal might go through, but what occurs in the wake of that is anybody's guess. And we could talk at length about that. I mean, I think we will a little bit today.
Let's simplify this for the audience, just in terms of what's going on with the insurers. What are insurance subrogation claims?
Great question. I want to make sure before I answer that, I am not an insurance expert. I'm not an insurance lawyer. I don't even know if I've ever made an insurance claim on my car. So like my experience is I pay my premiums. That's about it. I'm a good customer, but I have done some research. So I'll speak from that. So just to level set it. Here's how I think about how subrogation claims work. Let's imagine you're in your car and you're doing all the right things. You're under the speed limit. You're obeying all the stop signs, not rolling them. Your hands are attended to. Everything's good. And someone hits you. And in fact, this person was, and we're just going to make it really dramatic, in the passenger seat of their Cybertruck with the goggles on, you know, with three beverages, checking their phone, like doing everything that would be negligent. Like they hit you and it's totally their fault. Now this, depending on which state you're in, let's just say we're here in Minnesota. My understanding is my car is totaled. My insurance company cuts me a check or buys me a car, whatever. I'm covered. But what they then do is they go to seek damages or recover what they've paid from the person who 100% without a doubt caused this accident. So that's a subrogation claim. The insurer says, all right, I covered the damage. Okay, good. That's what the contract says. But then the contract also says, because these damages occurred because of negligence, the insurance company can go after the party that caused the accident. And in that case, they would go, I guess, first to that driver's insurance company and, you know, try to get them to recover if there's something more. And maybe they take that person to court and go on and on. So that's how I think about a subrogation claim. Now, in this context, think about it in a very similar way. So say you're a homeowner in Lahaina, you're a business owner in Lahaina, you have, you know, all the insurance that you paid for business recovery, home replacement, whatever, wildfire rolls through, insurance company pays you to put replacement cost of your house, your building, et cetera. Well, in this case, you know, there's a strong belief that negligence caused these fires. So then insurance subrogation holder, claim holder, the insurance company in this case, would go after the negligent party, who in this case has been asserted, includes Hawaiian Electric, and there's a whole host of other people. But that's how that works. So there are insurance companies that still hold these claims, and they are of the belief that they could go try to recover the monies that they've paid out from the parties that apparently were negligent in this case.
Bringing this all together in terms of what's going on here, we have a situation where the Maui County Circuit Judge, Peter Cahill, has made a ruling that the subrogation claims cannot go forward. Subsequently, within the past week, he's made an additional ruling that now he's going to kick this up to the Hawaiian Supreme Court to get their view on whether or not the subrogation claims can go forward. Let's assume that Cahill's ruling is upheld for the sake of this conversation. Can the insurance market in Hawaii work effectively without this?
So there's a lot there. This, I think, is like the crux of the situation. There are people who are waiting for this moment as far as like their expertise has been developed in the world of law and insurance. So that's a great question. I think not. And the reason why I think that the markets are going to be disrupted is as follows. It's less about situation. It's more about how it's very surprising to market participants. They were acting and believing as though these claims were valid. They had the right to pursue them. And as a result of that, they price risk in a certain way. And I don't have numbers. I can't say it's, you know, 10 cents, $200, whatever, but just directionally, that's the case. They price the risk in terms of premium that they commanded from their clients or in the marketplace with the expectation that they could go after negligent parties. And this is a great example of that. Now, if that's not the case and negligence occurs and, you know, a fire occurs and the insurance companies pay out and they can't go seek against negligent parties, it just sort of stands to reason that premiums need to go up. I don't, you know, I can't give you a quantum. So I think that's the best case, that if this is upheld and, you know, we are where we are, I think the best case for the market is that premiums just go up. Risk is repriced. I think that you could make the case, and it's not too hard to get there, that there's more, that maybe you can't price the risk according, you know, properly. Maybe it's just too expensive. Maybe no one can afford it. And then you're getting into situations like you've seen in other states, cities where natural disasters occur. And I know that this one's a little different because there's lots of negligence, but hurricanes, wildfires, landslides, whatever. Insurers just can't, the risk is too expensive and they might leave the market. So I think it's sort of baked into the cake that rates will go up. I think it's probably also very, very likely that market participants leave, and you could have a situation where all the market participants leave, and you've got the insurance, you know, the insurer of last resort, which Paul, you and I talked about this week. Is that like a Florida situation? I think there's a market in Louisiana where that occurs now. I know there are others where it's a, I don't know if it's a state thing, a federal thing, but State Farm, whoever, nope, this is not a plug for State Farm, but just as an example, State Farm may not be there anymore, and whoever, you know, whoever's in the market could leave. Yes, the markets will probably function, but they'll function like that. And I would call that dysfunctional.
Okay, so lot to unpack there, but what's the next important milestone now, given what we've talked about so far?
Yeah, there's a couple tracks, and I'll discuss them both, and then I'll bring them both together, right, where I think this goes. You mentioned Cahill's decision right around the time of the global settlement being inked. That was in early August. At the time, a 90-day window was set in motion, or the 90 days were granted for the plaintiffs' parties. Those are the parties that were uninsured or underinsured, you know, who are a big piece of the pie, as well as the subrogation claim holders. The judge said, hey, go, you know, go in your rooms, talk it out. And in 90 days, I'd like you to come back and tell me how you've concluded these negotiations. They literally have a pile of money, and now they have to try to figure out how to cut it between them. But they're doing so, the subrogation claim holders being told that they can't go after the defendants. So they've got, you know, one hand or both hands tied behind their back. But that's a 90-day process. So the first thought was that that's going to occur. And then sometime in early November, parties would come back and probably say, yeah, we don't have a deal. And then the subrogation claim holders would either go down the path that they're on, which is pursuing their own remedies, or perhaps having to take Cahill's decision to a higher court. And that would be the Supreme Court of Hawaii. What's interesting, and Paul, you noted this, was Friday, and all the best stuff happens on Fridays before major holidays. So Friday afternoon, and I'd say that tongue in cheek, but Friday afternoon, Cahill did a Stallone and went over the top, as it were. So it's a great movie if you haven't seen it, that dates me. But what he did is he said, all right, you know what? I'm just going to do it myself. And I don't know enough about how the Hawaiian legal system works, but he essentially just advanced the case already, as we know it, to the Supreme Court. So he kind of jumped ship, as it were, and took away that right from the subrogation holders. I laugh because it's just so weird. But in doing so, going back to the 90-day clock, from now, early September, people think it's about a month before the Supreme Court decides whether they're going to hear it or not. So that puts us into early October. If they hear it, people think it's going to take, I don't know, 3 to 6 months. So that probably derails that 90-day process. So sometime in early October, probably, we'll hear that the Supreme Court's going to hear this thing or not. If they do, then that prior 90-day process probably gets paused. If they don't, then that process probably goes on, and the subrogation holders probably end up taking it to the Supreme Court in November anyway. So that's the immediate next step. In the fog of what I just said, is there a deal to be had within the confines that have been put down by Cahill? So can the parties, plaintiff's parties, subrogation holders, are they going to find a way to cut this pie up in a way that makes everyone happy? I kind of don't think so, but maybe. Anyway, those are the parts that are moving right now. And there's a lot, and they kind of depend on each other. But I think if I'm gearing off of the next thing, it's early October to see if it's Supreme Court or not.
From your perspective, given the kind of work you've done as far as like this credit analysis work, and just thinking about what's been happening here with the settlement and the insurance companies, whenever everything is resolved, does this market go back to what it was before these wildfires, or is it on a path to permanently being changed?
I think it's a really good question, because I think most people are focused. There's so much going on, and you can be in the weeds on all these things, but that's a really good question. We talked about it a little bit this week too. I think it's permanently changed. You know, one of the things that we talked about a year ago was the expectation that somehow Hawaiian Electric would need to raise rates and use that as currency to probably raise money and then use that money to pay damages. Makes total sense. They give it like sort of like a tobacco bond, something like that. You know, it's tax, push it out 30, 40 years, bring it back on a present value notion. There's some money. Got it. Well, it sounds as though, and this is tea leaf, but I think the money that they've said that they're going to provide is probably what they think they can afford without raising rates, right? So, okay, cool. So we got this deal. No one's rates are going up. Thank you. Probably a good outcome. And I got it. Like, you don't want to raise rates on the people whose houses you just burned down. That's right. Not good business. I think we can agree that that's not a good look. How about that? It's not funny, but it's not a good look. Okay, so that happened. But we just talked about the insurance markets. So if this is the way they get there, you're going to pay more that way. So the parties that are now not having to pay higher electrical bills are going to have to probably pay more for insurance if they can get it. Okay, so that's a change. Or does this deal blow up? Does in trying to put this all together and leaving the insurance companies out of it, you know, who are big participants in a market that's going to move, does this deal blow up and we're back to where we were a year ago, wondering if Hawaiian Electric's going to have to file bankruptcy and then do they need to raise rates? So I think baseline is there will be changes and it's going to look like higher costs for everybody. It's going to look like radically different insurance markets for those who live there, including the victims of the wildfire, and really probably all people in the market that is Hawaii in a grander way. For Hawaiian Electric, they're going to probably have more debt on their balance sheet. You know, we can go through the analysis. That probably works. So for them, you know, what changes there? Probably not a lot. I mean, it's operationally, they probably got to keep the ship a little tighter than they were before just to manage more liabilities. But I think the big thing that's going to change is the insurance market. A year ago, I wouldn't have expected that to be the topic of conversation.
Well, John, I'm not a fortune teller, but I think you're going to be on another podcast in the future.
I love it.
Because there's a lot going on here and there's a lot of different ways this could shake out. I mean, it's hard to imagine just based on what you've been talking about that things go back to some kind of version of pre-wildfires, but I guess we have to wait and see how all this litigation works out. Thank you, John, for a great conversation on Hawaiian Electric. And to our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown.